This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in partnership with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. In April 1942, at least 500,000 people fled the city of Madras, now known as Chennai. The reason? The British, after weeks of growing unease about the possibility of a Japanese invasion, finally recommended that people leave the city. In the tense, uncertain atmosphere of 1942, many took that advice to heart and fled. The Japanese, of course, did not invade 1942, but between the attack on Pearl Harbor and, say, mid-42, when the Allies held back the Japanese advance, both the Indian colonial establishment and pro-independence activists thought carefully about the possibility of invasion and how to respond to it if it happened. Mukund Padmanabhan writes about this panic in his first book, The Great Flap 1942, How the Raj Panicked Over a Japanese Non-Invasion. Mukund is the former editor of The Hindu, one of India's largest, most respected newspapers. He was appointed to the post in 2016 after having been editor of the Business Daily Hindu Business Line. He is currently a senior professor of philosophy at Cray University near Chennai. Today, Mukund and I talk about the fierce debates in India about how to respond to the threat of a Japanese invasion during World War II. So, Mukund, thank you so much for coming on the show today. You know, maybe let's start with the benefit of hindsight. Was India under any real threat of Japanese invasion?
Well, with hindsight, now we know that there was absolutely no plan to invade India, not in 1942. What they did, and very successfully, was to create the impression that they might. They came very close to India. They bombed Colombo in Ceylon, what is now Sri Lanka. They bombed Trincomalee. They also conducted some air raids of a slightly minor nature on the east coast in Visakhapatnam and Kakinada. And then later on, of course, they bombed various parts of India in the northeast. I think they did that to disrupt, the sort of sense that the British sense of complacency, and also maybe to sort of signal to Indian nationalists that, look, Britain is increasingly incapable of ruling India. And I didn't think they did that pretty successfully. But yes, there was no plan at all to invade India.
So you spent a lot of time in your book discussing how kind of how Indian pro-independence activists, particularly, you know, Congress, thought about the war and the possibility of Japanese invasion. You know, broadly, how did these activists feel about the war, and what were some of the main internal divisions in terms of how to think about it?
I think there was a large body within the Congress that felt that Britain was weakened in a way with the entry to the war, and this was the right time to press for concessions. And that, this was the time to sort of strike a deal with Britain saying, all right, we'll support the war or support your war effort in exchange for some real constitutional reform, if not complete independence. So that, I think that was the sort of, that this body of opinion, I think, was sort of very, very strong in the Congress. But when we had someone like Gandhi, who, because of his, nonviolent creed, felt that any support for the war would go against his philosophy. And so he was reluctant to sort of accept any kind of participation in the British war effort. He thought that was simply not on. At least he felt that for a while.
I mean, speaking of Gandhi, his view of the war shifts a lot during this period. I mean, you quote some passages where he says, the best way for Britain to resist Nazi Germany would be to let them invade and nonviolently resist. I bet an argument that did not go over very well. But the way he thinks about the war and comments on the war does change over time. I mean, how did his view of, how nonviolence should be applied in this situation. How did that kind of change and adapt as the war continued?
You're right. There was a change. When the war broke out in 1939, well before Japan entered it, he basically took the line that the Congress wouldn't do anything to seriously embarrass the British at this time, at this critical time in history. So he resisted attempts for mass satyagraha, or mass action, and he was a restraint on the Congress. And he was restrained on, you know, he restrained those who felt that this was the time to strike and to push for, you know, and to sort of pressure the British to sort of give in more. I think there was a period in 42 after Japan's entry into the war where he got a little more radical, if you like, and by the sort of middle of 1942, he started taking a sort of stronger line. I mean, you know, Nehru himself says that his calls for independence had a certain strength to it, a sort of, you know, a sort of resolve to it. And so that was one change. And then towards the end, at a time, and I'm not suggesting this is linked in any way, after the Japanese defeats in the Pacific to the U.S. Navy, he actually allows foreign troops to be stationed to India, something that he'd been opposing all along. So there is a kind of shift in his attitude, and a shift that has not been explained fully in most of the works of history I've read.
Maybe to take a step back a bit, you know, the period between Pearl Harbor and mid-1942 was a string of consecutive defeats on the part of European armies versus Japan. I mean, the loss of Malaya, the loss of Burma, the loss of Singapore, the loss of the Philippines, the loss of Indonesia. So kind of string after string after string of defeats. And you know in your book that kind of the British response to those defeats ended up unnerving a lot of people in India. I wonder if you might kind of talk about that relationship a bit more.
Yeah, I mean, it didn't go unnoticed that, you know, the sort of entire British community had fled Penang, for instance, which, a sort of British historian has described as one of the most shameful act episode in Britain's history. So, and they realized that, you know, the British upped and left Malaya. So the question popped itself, you know, maybe you'll do the same to India. Maybe you're not stayers. And I think what Japan successfully signaled by through these string of victories was that, you know, when push comes to shove, the British might just leave. And that, I think, undermined Indian confidence in, you know, in the Raj tremendously.
I mean, there's also during this period the growth of the Indian National Army, and I know Bose shows up with the INA later, but there is a strain of, I guess, thought in the Axis movement that, you know, better to work with Japan, to work with Japan as liberators from the British, as opposed to be, I guess, to be worried or fearful of a possible invasion. I mean, how common was that strain of thought in some of this kind of in the pro-independence activist movements?
Well, I think the British certainly took note of the fact that the majority of people who surrendered to the Japanese just went over to the INA. It happened in Malaya. It happened in Singapore. And I think this certainly had an impact, which is hard to estimate. But I think there was always the fear that, look, if you can't hold the Indian army together, then you can't hold India together. Mm-hmm. And so the INA, in some sort of tangential way, did contribute to Indian independence. Of course, when the INA teamed up with the Japanese and attacked India in 1944, was a Japan that was weakened, tremendously. And then the British had got their act together. The Americans, there were a lot of American GIs and American military hardware in India, and they were pushed back fairly easily, and Burma was retaken. But the story was completely different in 1942. I think that's why the British were so worried about what would happen. And there was, I mean, I'm straying off topic, but there was also a naval mutiny in 1946. And, you know, I'm sure that sent tremors in the British establishment, because if you couldn't hold the military together, then you couldn't hold India together. Mm-hmm. So I think the birth of the INA, the fact that so many Indians just went over, did, I think, impress on the British that it's going to be harder and harder to hold India.
So, you know, the British were spooked by this. Did they ever really offer anything to convince convince Indians to back the war effort? What were kind of the main divisions on the British side?
Well, they, you know, Churchill was on one side. I mean, he really didn't want to, you know, let India go. You know, he was damned if he's going to do that. He said that on more than one occasion. But he was kind of forced because of the overall geopolitical circumstances and because of pressure from Roosevelt, particularly, to do something for India. And so he sent Stafford Cripps, and there was a Cripps mission. And the entire objective of the Cripps mission was to offer something in return for support for the war, you know, principally Congress support for the war. But there was not enough on the table. And Gandhi in any way was completely opposed to supporting the war. So the Cripps mission, you know, was something of a non-starter, but I think it helped Churchill signal to Roosevelt and others that, and he was running a national government at that time, that he was keen on bringing India on board for the war effort, but not enough was offered clearly.
Mm-hmm. So how do India's civilian populations, you know, particularly on the eastern coast, how do they think or, I guess, worry about the war? You know, there seems to be a lot of kind of several kind of haphazard evacuation plans. Nothing seems to be particularly well thought out. There's a lot of panic, but how are civilian populations thinking about the possibility of war and of invasion?
I think the fear and the panic that emerged because of something that was never going to happen is at the heart of the story of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Why did, for instance, you know, something between 75% to 90% of the population flee Madras? Why did people flee Bombay, for instance, which was on the western seaboard? Why did people flee the interior? Places, there was an exodus from places like Delhi and Ahmedabad and Jamshedpur.
Mm-hmm.
People even fled hill stations, which, you know, nowhere near the coast, like Ooty and Kodaikanal. So I think the reason for this, there are a number of reasons for this. One is that the British actually encouraged a part of the exodus. I mean, they felt in the event that there would be a Japanese bombing, it would be easier to manage a city with less people in it. And there's enough evidence to suggest that it was very much of the part of their policy. They used words like useless mouths or inessentials. They would have liked these useless mouths to leave the cities, and they would like the people that they thought was essential, people engaged in the essential services or people engaged in, you know, producing equipment for the war, to remain. That was the sort of, you know, the sort of managerial issue that they were kind of grappling with at the time. So I think the exodus was they contributed to this, the mixed messaging. In Madras, the last phase of the exodus, and people started fleeing, you know, pretty much soon as Malaya was attacked. So they started fleeing in 1941. The last phase of the exodus in April 1942 happened simply because of wrong military intelligence. I mean, you know, the Governor Hope of the Madras Presidency was told that a large Japanese fleet was going to head into the southern coast of what is now Tamil Nadu. And so, you know, the government itself scatters and flees. I mean, that was simply bad intelligence. So there are many reasons why people fed. And they allowed rumors to take root because they were very, you know, economical with the truth. When Rangoon was bombed, for instance, They didn't tell the truth about the sort of carnage in Rangoon. And these stories just emerged from refugees and others. So there was a feeling that the British were hiding something. There was a feeling that the news couldn't be trusted. It took India about a fortnight to learn that the Japanese had taken the Andaman and Nicobar Islands.
Mm-hmm.
Andaman Islands. So I think there were many reasons that led to it. And the panic was at least partly of British making.
Yeah, I mean, so let's talk a bit more about this kind of the information ecosystem of the time, as it were. I mean, you note that George Orwell was involved with the British propaganda stuff, but he thought it was a huge waste of money and it never worked. He thought it never worked. Obviously, the Italians and the Nazis tried to have propaganda going into India. I mean, Bose was based in Berlin for a time. Yeah, so there was a lot of propaganda going on. The British tried their own propaganda. It wasn't hugely successful. There was a lot of this kind of hesitation between kind of giving enough information to not freak people out, but not too much information. So like, how was the, like, again, this term, the information ecosystem in India at that time?
I think they grappled with the idea of whether they should tell the truth, how much to tell. And sometimes I think they weighed in on the wrong side. The news about Burma, particularly, the way it was handled, I think, was not very well. In fact, you had Governor Hope of the Madras Presidency actually writing to the Viceroy Linlithgow saying, please don't fudge what happened in Burma, because this is just leading to more panic. So we've had we had a climate where rumors were sort of allowed to a free play. And I think in balance, it probably would have been better to tell the truth, because you in Malaya and in Singapore, you had a lot of Indians, relatives of people who lived in India there. And the news sort of trickled in. And then when the news trickled in, this came in sometimes in the form of rumors, and people became credulous and they were willing to believe all kinds of things. So I think the rumors did play a role. And there was the cycle of rumor and then panic and flight, which would again trigger fresh rumors, fresh panic, fresh flight. So this became a sort of, a sort of vicious circle in a way.
You know, you mentioned already that the government fled Madras when this bad military intelligence came in. But how did, colonial officials, British people, how did they react to the possible threat of invasion? And, personal history here. My grandmother, my great-grandfather, my great-grandmother were in Madras in Chennai during this time. Certainly before 41, my grandmother went kind of back and forth between England and India, but they were in India during this period. I don't know if they fled the city. I get the feeling that maybe my great-grandfather thought this was all kind of, he thought some of these drills were ridiculous. But in general, I mean, how did colonial people feel about like what did they do in response to the threat of invasion?
Well, I mean, your great grandfather worked for Paris, right?
Yes.
So Paris was located pretty close to the harbor, pretty close to the beach, and that area, the so-called Madras Fortress area, was evacuated.
Mm-hmm.
But Paris didn't stop functioning. They just moved various divisions to the houses of their managers. So they split up and they did operate in a few places. And after a while, they moved from the city. So they never stopped operations fully. As far as the others, pretty much the entire population sort of left for other places, including officials. And if you're talking about, Europeans at that time, I have this bit about how there was a panic in the hill station of Kodaikanal, and you had a sort of exodus from there of Americans and British people who actually fled because of some rumor that the Japanese were going to invade Kodaikanal. Mm-hmm. And, if you look at the geography of India, that is so far-fetched. It's quite incredible that... So it wasn't just Indians who fled. I mean, the British sometimes, peddle the story that, you know, Indians were timid and they were prone to fleeing. But the panic pretty much gripped everyone during that period, irrespective of race or class or color. Yeah.
You know, one thing I hadn't ever really realized before reading your book, but it's kind of obvious in hindsight, but, you know, was the idea that suddenly you had all of these foreign troops based in India. You know, you mentioned a lot of British troops, American troops, Chinese troops were suddenly now based in India. And that, you know, had an impact on how Indians thought about the war and thought about society. I mean, how did inside you react to suddenly having this large population of foreign soldiers like in its cities?
Well, that fueled the panic. Maybe it shouldn't have fueled the panic, but they did. You know, people thought war was imminent, and that led to people fleeing. There was also this fear of soldiers, and sometimes of white soldiers, which I've recorded in the book. People feared their women were unsafe. Some of this was irrational, but there were some incidents that were real. But a lot of it was exaggerated. A lot of it couldn't be corroborated. So there was this fear. There was also, as I record, a surge in prostitution at that time. I mean, you know, in India, simply because I think foreign white soldiers were better paid. And so they had greater access to, to women, I guess, if they wanted some kind of recreation. And this was a debate that actually played out in the Central Legislative Assembly. Stories about molestation, allegations of molestation that couldn't be confirmed. So, yes, you know, the influx of the sort of great increase in soldiers, both Indian and from abroad, was a factor that actually fueled the panic.
So this holds until about, let's say, mid-1942. I mean, there's the panic doesn't last forever. What changes to, I guess, allow the threat of Japanese invasion to recede or kind of appear to recede? You note again, they try invading Northeast India in 44. It doesn't go very well. But what changes in kind of like mid 1942 onwards?
So in April 1942, two Japanese fleets sail into the Indian Ocean. One of them is headed by Nagumo, who's Vice Admiral, who's the hero of Pearl Harbor. And he's there with something like six aircraft carriers. It's a fairly large fleet. And there's another one in the Bay of Bengal, which is actually taking down merchant ships. And Nagumo is sort of, you know, trying to liquidate the Eastern Fleet, the Britain's Eastern Fleet. Because once Singapore has fallen, the headquarters has moved to Trincomalee in Ceylon. Luckily for the British, Somerville, who's the head of that fleet, and a number of ships have actually sailed away to the Maldives, where they have another base, which the Japanese don't know about. So they come close in April. And that's, you know, is a reality. They come close, they take down merchant ships, they bomb Vishakhapatnam, they bomb Kakinada. And so there is a feeling that the threat is very real at that time. Soon after, the fleets are recalled and they go back to the Pacific because I think they have bigger battles to fight. Mm-hmm. And they fight two major battles with the US, and the second one is a bit of a disaster. Mm-hmm. And I think Japan just completely loses its supremacy over the sea. And I think that's a major turning point in the war.
You know, that's actually a good segue to my last question, which is, you know, it's very easy with the benefit of hindsight to look back at the Pacific theater and think Japan had no way of winning, you know, versus the US's imperial might in the Pacific, you know, after Midway and all of this stuff. But, you know, obviously that's a very US-centric view. That's a very Pacific-centric view rather than an Asia one. And, you know, given kind of your study of this initial like 6 to 8 month period, where it looked like Japan was really on the verge of beating everybody. You know, what do we miss when we think about the war, you know, in that US-centric way, where it's like the US was poised to win everything because it was just so strong economically and industrially? And how do, and what do we miss about how people probably felt during the first 6 to 8 months of war with Japan?
How did people actually feel, as in?
What do we miss when we take this very Pacific centric view of the war?
I think people play down when they write about India, and Gandhi actually acknowledges that there was a fairly large constituency of people who believe that it doesn't matter whether it's Japan or Britain, it's just one more exploiter. Maybe the Japanese will actually be better, the Asians, unlike the British. Maybe they'll treat us better. We know they treated, for instance, Indian soldiers far better than, the Chinese and people from other nationalities. They had a strategy of sort of wooing Indian soldiers, because it was a part of their sort of foreign policy objective of creating a greater, East Asia co-prosperity sphere. They had a reason to do that, and I think there was sympathy. We for instance know that the sort of radio, the British worried about why the radio from Berlin and the Japanese broadcasts were getting more popular than their own. They worried about the rumors and the stories about how kindly the Japanese were treating Indians. Mm-hmm. And they kept reminding them, look at what the Japanese did in China, wake up and smell the coffee. But there was a constituency in India that probably believed that at that time, not later, that it wouldn't, matter whether the Japanese came and maybe they would be better than the British. In some ways, Gandhi himself suggests that constituency was fairly sizable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a great place to end our conversation with Mukund Padmanabhan, author of The Great Flap of 1942, How the Raj Panicked Over a Japanese Non-Invasion. Mukund, I actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work, all of your work, not just this book? And also, what's next for you? What do you think the next project might be?
Well, I mean, right now, as far as the book goes, I've only sold the rights for India. But I think my agent is sort of casting around in Britain to find a publisher, and I hope it gets one. A lot of my other writing has been done in the Hindu and in other newspapers. I have written essays, but only essays in other books. This is, as you mentioned, my first book. What next? I will embark on another project. I'm not entirely sure what shape or form it'll take, but it will have to do with a slice of colonial history again, going back into the 18th century.
Right.
Going back a couple of hundred years here.
Well, looking forward to it, whatever the project may be. You can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at Nick R.I. Gordon. That's NickRigordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow them on Twitter at Book Reviews Asia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network, NewBooksNetwork.com. We're on all the podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends. Support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Next week, join us for an interview with Rajrishi Singhal, author of Slip, Stitch, and Stumble, The Untold Story of India's Financial Sector Reforms. But before then, Mukund, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you. Entirely my pleasure.